Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Tissell, attorney registration number 29648 from the law firm of Burke, Simpson, Eldridge, Hirsch, and Jardine. I am here representing the plaintiff appellant, Pueblo del Sol, LLC, or PDS. First, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time. I understand from your honor that I need to watch that, but that is my intention in terms of argument. PDS respectfully asks that you vacate and reverse the trial court's judgment entered on a jury verdict after a 2-week trial for the following 3 reasons. First, the trial court erred in entering a money judgment of over $1 million on an affirmative defense that was pled by the bank of set-off. Affirmative defenses and counterclaims are two strikingly different things. And in this case, what the jury found is that the bank was in breach of the contract. The jury never found that Pueblo del Sol, or PDS, was in breach. Nor did the jury ever find that the bank had proven any of the elements of the breach of contract claim. At best, what the jury found was an amount that could be set off against the affirmative award that the jury found in favor of Pueblo del Sol. It is Hornbook law that while a properly proven set-off affirmative defense may reduce the amount that a defendant may have to pay on a judgment that's been awarded to the plaintiff, it cannot result in an actual affirmative money judgment here of over $1 million without there ever actually having been a proof of the elements of the counterclaim of breach of contract that the bank brought.
Counsel, how do we know that the number the jury entered on the verdict form was a set-off, because the word set-off doesn't appear anywhere in the verdict form. It just says the amount, if any, that plaintiffs owed to defendant Legacy Bank under the loan, that could be because of a breach of contract.
Your Honor, I have two answers to that. First of all, jury instruction 26, which was given over the objection of our counsel, Mr. Matisse, at the time, actually explains verdict form A, and explains that that is the verdict form as to the breach of contract claim that is being brought by Pueblo del Sol, and tells the jury that if they find in favor of Pueblo del Sol and against the bank on the breach of contract claim, then they have to move to the set-off affirmative defense. And so we tendered two dueling, let me back up. I think that's an important question. It's where I'm going next, but that's my second point. But we believe that what this case properly was two dueling breach of contract claims. That's what was brought. That's what was in the trial management order. Pueblo del Sol said the bank breached by A, not fully funding what they had promised to fund, and then calling the loan due 3 years before the maturity date. The bank, of course, had a different view and believed that the maturity date was 3 years earlier in 2008, that they could that we were in breach by not having paid back at that point in time. That was the factual question that was given to the jury. The jury found the bank was in breach by not funding and by calling the loan due early.
Well, we don't know the precise nature of the breach, do we? Because you had alternative theories on breach, and the jury wasn't asked to decide which theory of breach it agreed with.
I think that's also an excellent point, Your Honor. We don't know exactly. Explicitly, we don't know.
It could have been failure to fund, or it could have been calling it due 3 years early, or could have been both. We just don't know.
I would suggest that we actually do know from the jury's verdict, Your Honor. And the reason is that at trial, the bank didn't just argue that they had an amount that was still due and owing on the note, but that it had come due and that we were in breach as of 2008, 2 years before the trial date. And they asked not only for the principal amount to be awarded to them on that jury verdict form, but also the interest and penalties that would go along with the date of breach having been 2008. The jury only entered the principal amount that was due. Remember, all that they were asked, which goes to the second point, the second reason I believe judgment needs to be vacated and reversed, is that the jury's verdict never established the elements of the affirmative defense. The only question that was asked over Pueblo del Sol's objection was how much is still owed by Pueblo del Sol on the note. And much like a 30-year mortgage that one of us may have on our homes that we may owe $200,000 on still 25 years from now, the fact that we still owe that money doesn't mean that it's presently due, and certainly doesn't mean that we've been in default.
I understand that, counsel, but let me back up to the nature of the objections here. You said that there was an objection to Instruction 26. Was this objection to the entire idea of set-off being presented to the jury, or was it something else? I mean, are you saying the bank wasn't entitled to assert set-off as an affirmative defense at all?
I think that there was an objection to the use of the set-off objection in the verdict form as it was used because of the very problems that we're here for today.
I'm going back to Instruction 26, which you had referred to earlier.
Yes.
What was the objection to Instruction number 26 as it regards set-off?
That the set-off should not have been presented, that what was really at issue here, what was pled and what was presented to the jury were two dueling breach of contract claims. Who was correct about what the maturity date was under the contract? If Pueblo del Sol was correct, then their which we contend the jury's verdict clearly finds, since Pueblo del Sol was not found in breach and the bank was, if Pueblo del Sol was correct, then their obligation to repay the loan would not arise for another 6 months after the trial date, February of 2011. So nothing would be due at the time of the trial. If the bank was correct, then the amount would have been due in 2008 based upon their view. And then there would have been an entitlement to interest, at least interest.
But couldn't the bank plead? I mean, its theory was that the loan was due in 2008. Why is pleading set off in addition to breach of contract inconsistent or not allowed because of that? They can plead both, can't they?
I think they can plead both. I think the proper approach in this case were that you had two competing theories. As part of what you can, same thing that happened in the briefing that you've all read before you, is that we have two completely different visions of what this case is. And one party was right and one party was wrong. And we believe the jury clearly found that the bank was in breach and that the only way that you can read the jury's finding consistently is that the breach was not only in not funding, but in calling the loan due. When they called the loan due at that point in time, there was no ability for Pueblo del Sol to do what they obtain a loan to begin with for, which was to acquire and then fully develop the property. And then, just like any other typical land development loan, they would then sell lots, and as they sold lots, they would repay the loan to the bank and have those lots released and or pay a balloon payment date in 2011.
Counsel, how does continuing to object to the set-off instruction, and that was clear, I mean, it's clear that the set-off is always in contention, how could that have alerted the trial court to the fact that the verdict forms would result in, you know, what happened here and the jury never getting to Form B? Shouldn't that have been pointed out to the trial court specifically so that it could correct that?
Your Honor, I think that's an excellent point. And it goes to one of the battles in the briefing before you. What we have here is we have the judge entering the trial. What we are challenging is that this was not done in post-trial motions. This was not done where the court actually had discretion to address that point. This was done where the jury verdict came in late on a Friday night, and early on Monday, the following Monday morning, the judge conducted the ministerial act, it should have been a ministerial act, of just entering the judgment at that point in time. And when the judge did that, the judge did not have the discretion to impose what it believed, the trial court did not have the discretion to impose what it believed the jury's verdict was. And so we contend the only judgment that could have been entered at that point in time would have been the judgment in favor of Pueblo del Sol. And then, Judge Jones pointed out, to the extent there was going to be any set-off that was applied, that could have been addressed at that point too. But to go ahead and then enter an affirmative judgment of $1 million, of over $1 million, without there actually have been any findings of breach of contract by Pueblo del Sol, goes against over 100 years of law in Colorado.
But that's what the verdict form allowed for. And so, I mean, to the extent that the verdict form ended up resulting in what happened here, I mean, wasn't it incumbent on one or the other party to tell the court so that it could correct it in time, I mean, before the jury returned it?
We objected to the jury verdict form. We objected to the instruction number 26. But again, I think it's very important here. In terms of the questions that were asked of the jury and the responses that they actually gave, that wasn't the problem. The problem here was then in the court taking those questions and answers and then entering judgment affirmatively for the bank without there have been any proof of a breach of contract by Pueblo del Sol. There could not have been a breach of contract by Pueblo del Sol under the facts if the bank had been found in breach. We know from the Coors case that the first in breach doctrine here in Colorado, the Colorado Supreme Court holds that if a party is in breach of contract, here the bank, they can't use that contract as the ability to, or as the impetus to demand performance from the non-breaching party. I'm not saying that there may not have been some other relief for this bank or a bank in similar circumstances under equitable grounds, under an unjust enrichment claim, something of that sort. None of those were ever pled. What the bank chose to do was bring a breach of contract claim. And once it was found to be in breach of contract, under the Coors case, they can't use that contract as the impetus to force repayment or performance by the other party.
Counsel, does the record show which party tendered the verdict forms?
Yeah, Your Honor, and I think, thank you, Your Honor. I have that in my notes. And
do you have a record cite for that?
I can, if I have a break here, I can give you a record cite. I will tell you that there was representation made in the briefing by the bank that these instructions were tendered by Pueblo del Sol, and that is not correct. Verdict form as well. Pueblo del Sol did not tender the verdict form.
Okay.
What was tendered by Pueblo del Sol was rejected by the court, which again was our position that these were two competing breach of contract claims.
Both sides submitted their own version of what they wanted to go to the jury.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
I see I have 3 minutes left, unless there's any questions at this point.
You may.
May it please the court. My name is Murray Wiener. My bar number is 14352, and I represent the Appalee Legacy Bank. Let me just address the question that Judge Fox or Judge Jones just asked. I can't remember which one over who did the jury instruction form just for a second. If you look at the transcript on day four, page six, going on to page seven, this is what the judge said. Now, as to the instruction, the court went over instructions yesterday with counsel, and I think we figured out, at least when we left here last night, what those instructions would be, with some exceptions as to what the special interrogatories would be in the verdict. And those are going to be drafted by Mr. Matisse and submitted to Mr. Wiener for review as well as the court. Mr. Matisse is with the Berg Law Firm, and he submitted them. We had a conference at night. There were a series of conferences that went on off the record, as you're aware, during the course of this two-week trial. These are competing contract claims. The jury understood what it was being asked to do. The jury followed the verdict form precisely.
Well, let me see if I can clarify this, who tendered the verdict form issue, because for me it's important.
Sure.
That passage you just quoted from indicates that an obligation was placed on one party to draft them. But I'm just asking what actually happened. Is there any record of what actually happened?
I think that's in the actual record. I mean, what happened was is that each party submitted full sets, and then during the 2 weeks we were in Pueblo, they were from Denver, I was from Colorado Springs. Mr. Matisse was going back and forth. But the general gist of things was is that he took the laboring oar in submitting the verdict form. But Judge, to be direct about this, Judge Schwartz stuck it together. I mean, I'm being absolutely direct about it, but that's what happened. And he told us, this is the form I'm giving. And then in the instruction, you can see in the instruction conference where we had various discussions about things, but that's how it happened. But let me turn directly to the stipulation that we reached on the record, because I think that's at the crux of all of this. And it's in my brief, it's in the instruction conference, it's very important. I think, Judge Fox, one of your questions, or two of your questions, really relate to how did they preserve this? I mean, that's exactly it. The punchline here is that this is what I said was, this is important. If we reach it, I started discussing this, and Mr. Matisse stood up and So I deferred to Mr. Matisse, and Mr. Matisse said this: "There's, Your Honor, there's two calculations the jury performs on verdict form A, depending on whether to answers to question three, which would be Pueblo Del Sol's damages, are greater than question four, which is damages of the bank, or vice versa. They would answer either question five or question six." And this is the important part. "If the jury gets to either questions five or six, and they should put a number on one of them, but not both, then it would be appropriate for the court to enter judgment, if otherwise appropriate, for either Pueblo Del Sol or for Legacy Bank." The judge says, okay, and then I say, "And that's true, even though it's above the line that says verdict form B, and that's the stipulation that we're agreeing to." And the court says, okay, all right. So what was going on here is we had two competing contract claims in verdict form A, and we had a contract claim in verdict form B. And if you follow the instructions in between all the questions on the verdict form, it's like a roadmap. Go to this street, turn right, go to that street, and it uses the phrase net damages at least four times. So, and you know, the jury wrote in $315,000 for the plaintiff, and then it wrote in 1.6 million, approximately 1.587, and then it did the subtraction correctly. And the $1.587 million was exactly the amount of the loan plus the interest forwarded during that six-month period of time. And of course, we have an amendment to promissory note, joint exhibit number three, which specifically, absolutely, clearly said the loan matures on August 29th of 2008. So the jury had a basis for finding that the loan had matured. Not called, matured. So the punchline is that the stipulation and the verdict form follow each other precisely.
Counsel, your opponent, at least in the briefing, suggests that his stipulation merely went to sort of the math component, how you would calculate,
sure,
you know, what you subtract off of what, and it didn't, that he continued to preserve his objections about the competing breach of contract claims and the set-off instruction. How do you respond to,
sure,
to that contention?
Well, I disagree with that. I mean, the stipulation I just read and the verdict form itself say if line six is greater than, I'm going to get the lines right, I have the verdict form in front of me right here. If line four is greater than line three, then they're to go to line six and put the number in. If question three is bigger than line four, then they're to put the number in five. And then it says, and this is the most important point, I think, then in the stipulation, Mr. Matisse, not me, he had the stipulation correct, says, then it would be appropriate for the court to enter judgment, if otherwise appropriate, for either Pueblo Del Sol or Legacy Bank. So on the 6th, Mr. DeSell's correct. We were there late Friday night. That was a Friday. On the Monday, under Rule 58A, the judge followed the stipulation exactly. He took the number 1.272 million, whatever it is, and he entered judgment under Rule 58A, just like the law tells him to do, and just like the stipulation we agreed to said. So the judge didn't do anything. He followed the law precisely, he followed the stipulation precisely, and he followed the verdict form precisely. If we go to the verdict form, we see it says net damages over and over. Clearly, the jury understood, look, here's what's going on. A pox on both your houses. You're both at fault. There are two breaches here. $315,000 is what we're awarding Pueblo Del Sol, and we're saying they have to pay the money back to you. That's what they did, and then they netted it out. So we know the jury knew what they were doing. Let me address a question I think Judge Jones was getting at, and that is, so how do you make sense of all of this? How do you make sense of this? Okay, well, there's a lot of ways that they didn't identify which breach they were talking about. And the jury instruction, the verdict forms are general and the instructions are very specific, but the verdict form is like a who wins kind of verdict form. It's very general. Okay, so what happened? One way, there's many ways the jury could have done this, but one way is this way. On August 29th, 2008, the loan hasn't been paid back. Joint Exhibit 3 says, the amendment to the note says the maturity date is August 29th. They breached. They didn't pay the money back. And it could have said simultaneously, they never found participants, and therefore, we're going to say your out-of-pocket damages are $315,000. Or it could have said the out-of-pocket damages are much higher, but we proved on mitigation defense. But since the instructions don't clarify these things, you have to read them as a whole. All the other instructions were not objected to, essentially, except number 26, the set-off instruction. And again, set-off isn't in the verdict forms, only breaches are. And let me comment a little bit about the form of the one could say, why did the judge do it this way? Why did he have two breach of contracts in A and a breach of contract in B? And you'll see if you get to B, it says, don't go here if you took care of business in verdict form A. And clearly the jury didn't go to B and knew what it was doing. But the point is that he could have done it many different ways. He could have done it, a verdict form A only breach that way and a verdict form B differently. He could have done it many ways. There's nothing wrong with what he did. And again, the question before this court is whether there's reversible error here, not whether or not there's a better way to do it. And maybe there was a better way to do it, but the answer is that's what he did and the jury got it. So one is a simultaneous breach. By the way, there was no time limit in any of the loan documents about when they had to find participations. That's very important. Not any of them. So it could have been they didn't pay the maturity and we still had a duty allegedly to find participants. We didn't find participants. And so maybe we breached the agreement after that. If you look at Exhibit 78, it's a timeline that was admitted into evidence because all the elements on that timeline were addressed as fact and the judge admitted it to evidence. You'll see that they kept on talking between August 29th and December 15th when Pueblo del Sol filed their complaint. So another way it could have been that the breach was is they didn't pay the loan back and we didn't get participants there simultaneously or there. That's another way to do it. A third way to do it is that there was an instruction that was given over our objection for good faith and fair deal. Maybe the jury decided, hey, you get your money back, they breached, they didn't pay it back, but you didn't act in good faith, fair dealing, there was an instruction, I think it was number 15. So there's a lot of ways the jury could have done this. And I would say this, by necessity, the jury found that the loan matured, or they wouldn't have awarded us the exact loan amount. I mean, the answer is that's what they did. Let me back up, though, and just address this first material breach concept. Obviously, they didn't meet the burden of proving first material breach. Why? Because the jury entered numbers for them and for us. So either the jury found that they didn't breach, or we didn't breach first, or the breach wasn't material, or they found both of those things. But in any event, they didn't find first material breach, and they didn't prove the first material breach, and the jury had the right to find two breaches. The case of Lowry versus Palm, I may be pronouncing that wrong, Lowry versus Palm, is relevant, at least the facts are. In that case, this is a sale of a fly fishing business, I think, and the seller, the buyer bought the business, the seller was supposed to stay on for 10 years as an employee. Real quick, the seller quits. The court determined that was a breach of his contract. But it didn't excuse the buyer from having to pay the balance of the purchase price because the buyer received the business at the outset. Our case is similar. I mean, they got $1.6 million right up front. There was a duty in there of some sort. We argued that it was just a best efforts duty to find participants. Lehman Brothers had failed. The market crashed. We couldn't find participants. And so as a practical matter, what happened was is that their argument was is we had a duty to find participants, even though we couldn't force other banks to do this. And of course, our legal lending limit was $680,000, and we'd only found one participant before the closing. What really happened, of course, was is that we couldn't find them before the closing, and they had to close by March 1st because they were buying out a partner. They put no money into this project whatsoever, and what's going on here is simply that they ended up simply Mordini and Waters ended up becoming a partner in this thing, and then nothing else ever happened.
Either of the verdict forms A or B, I don't believe either of them address this whole first material breach issue?
Correct. There were three affirmative defenses that were in here. One was first material breach, one was set off, and the other was mitigation. None of those affirmative defenses found their way into the verdict form. They were just as part of the 30 or so, you have to read them as a whole, they were there, and then there was a general form. So none of them are addressed. There's no specific findings. What we're doing is we're speculating about what the jury was thinking, and I'm pointing out that, first of all, it's improper for us to speculate. If they didn't object to the verdict form, then the answer is that we shouldn't be sitting here trying to speculate on how the jury did it. But I am pointing out that the jury had the right and the ability and the evidence to be able to find two competing breaches. It had the right to go ahead and set $5, $10 minus $7 equals $3. And the judge had the right and the direction, of course, under 58A to do that. I want to point to one case that I didn't cite in my brief, but is cited in the cases I cited in my brief, if I can just find it here. It is Bear Valley Church of Christ versus DeBose, 928P3rd 1315. Justice Lohr in the Colorado Supreme Court, 96. The failure to object to or tender instructions or verdict forms waived the claim that the instructions or the verdict forms allowed inconsistent or duplicative jury awards. I don't think there was anything inconsistent in any way about this verdict in any way. But if they're contending, and I think they are, that it was duplicative or inconsistent, the answer is that they didn't object to it. And they stipulated if the line for the bank is bigger than the net damages are in my favor, my client's favor, judge, you enter judgment. That's a damages issue, not a set-off issue. I'd like to raise one other thing, and I simply call it to the court's attention. In this case, this court, what happened was a few days before the opening brief was filed, Mr. Waters filed bankruptcy. A few days after the opening brief was filed, Mr. Mordini filed bankruptcy. I understand 11 U.S.C. 362, and I'm afraid of it. And therefore, I filed a motion to stay briefing while I tried to figure out whether or not, if I filed my brief, I would be in violation of federal law. I don't like to do that. And so I did that. And the court on April 18th of 2011, I think it was, entered a very short one-sentence order, and it said, proceedings are stayed. Of course, this court had ordered, if they wanted to stay, the trial court, on December 2nd, 2010, what they said was, you have to post a $2.4 million supersedious bond. They never posted a supersedious bond. But what happened here is that subsequent, my job is I try a jury trial, I win a jury trial, I try to collect my judgment. I proceeded to do that because Pueblo del Sol was not a debtor. And what happened is I found myself, my client, my firm, my partner, all sued in Pueblo County District Court saying that I had violated the April 18, 2011 order of this court that said proceedings are stayed. And of course, what this court meant was my motion is granted, briefing is stopped. But right, the Pueblo court has sent a order to this court, and I ask simply that you address it. And it says to clarify what you meant in the April 18, 2011 order. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Your time has up. I think you have just under 3 minutes.
Thank you. To address Judge Jones' question before I took the break, coming back, citations to the record. Record of appeal, page 2895. Those are the special interrogatories and the four proposed verdict forms that were presented with our questions. I appreciate that Mr. Wiener's change in position, that it wasn't us who actually presented the jury verdict form, but that it was the judge who decided the jury verdict form that he was going to give. The actual, which is different than what was said in the briefing. That record site is actually what we had tendered, consistent with what I have argued to you this morning, Your Honor. I think it's also important, Judge Fox, to your question about whether there was objection and whether that was maintained, and questioning our position that the excerpt that was read to you was talking about the mechanics of what happened. I think reading only that and not reading all of the other objections that Mr. Matisse clearly made in the jury instruction conference is misleading and does not show the objections that were made. And again, citations to the record, volume 8, 639, lines 6 through 17. That is objection. That is an objection during the conference on giving the instruction of the affirmative defense. It is the position of the plaintiffs that this case involves two competing breach of contract claims, and that the court should determine any set-offs after the jury separately considers those two claims. At the record of appeal, volume 8, 641, line 21 through 642, line 3. That is the objection and the explanation of the objection on jury instruction number 26, Your Honor. And again, Record Appeal, Volume 8, page 643, 17 through 644, line 1. Again, this is the specific objection to questions 4, 5, and 6 on the jury verdict form that we are talking about today for the very reasons that we briefed for you today. And again, Record of Appeal, Volume 8, 646, line 21 through 647, line 13. And again, affirming that we object to the verdict form and to the instruction being given and to the process that the court is doing. Again, what happened here, all of the questions that were asked and the answers the jury gave are completely consistent with what our position is in the case. And that what happened here is when the judge, performing a ministerial act of taking that jury verdict and reducing it to judgment, it introduced its own belief that the bank had to get it paid back, that the bank had to be paid back the loan, despite there being no evidence that there was a breach, despite no interest being awarded, apparently upon the belief that it magically became due that Friday night when the verdict came in, entered judgment wrongly in favor of the bank. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case will stand submitted, and a written decision will issue in due course. And when